always the major.
Well, good evening, everyone. So welcome to the afternoon meeting of Health and Human Services Finance Division. Calling the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum, but we have presentations today. I'd like to get started on that. And we've delayed people a lot already, making them wait until now to come and give presentations. And, of course, members of the audience who came to hear this and other people who wanted to, the testifiers that we have. So we could get started. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Mingy. I'm sorry we might pause at some moment here when we do get a quorum, but please go ahead and get us started.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Anna Mingy from Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm just here to sort of set the stage of where we are with the Health Care Access Fund, provide a little background on what the fund is and the current forecast for the fund. And then the Departments of Health and Human Services will provide a lot more detail about the services that are funded through the Health Care Access
Fund. Okay, and I don't know what it is about this room, but you might need your mic a bit closer. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Health Care Access Fund was established in 1992, and it is primarily funded through a 2% tax on health care providers and a 1% tax on health maintenance organizations. The fund was established to fund activities that improve access to health care and contain the cost of health care. Over time, the uses of the fund have changed, but from the very beginning, the fund included appropriations for programs at the Department of Human Services, MDH, and other state agencies and higher education institutions. As I mentioned, the fund is primarily supported through a tax on healthcare providers and a tax on HMO premiums. On the slide in front of you, the large blue section are $1.3 billion in forecast revenues for the current biennium, or about 80% of revenues into the fund come from the provider tax. And the next largest source is that premium tax we discussed. There are also some revenues from premiums paid by Minnesota Care enrollees. And periodically we have transfers in or out to the general fund triggered by certain provisions in statute.
Okay, and excuse me, just one moment, Ms. Mingy. So I just want to point out to members that in your packet there are two different sets of slides that are kind of similar looking, and they're different, though. So be sure that you have the one that says Healthcare Access Fund Overview, and it does have Ms. Mingy's name on it. The other one is Commissioner Malcolm. So just make sure you got the right packet in front of you. Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you for clarifying. The thing I'd like to point out in the visual in front of you is that the revenue from the provider tax is falling significantly from the current biennium to the next, and that's because the provider tax is scheduled to sunset under current law at the end of calendar year 2019, which is the year that we are currently in. So in 2021, we expect about $463 million in revenue. And then when you look at 2022-23, there's no forecast revenue from the provider tax. One thing to consider when evaluating revenue sources for funding state programs is the stability of the revenue source. The chart in front of us displays historic growth in provider tax collection and historic growth in HMO premium tax collection. This the real takeaway from these two visuals is to say that the provider tax generally grows in line with healthcare spending growth. It's a very broad-based tax, and that is supported by the fact that over the last 10 years or so, the average annual growth for the tax has been about 4%, and the average annual growth in healthcare spending in Minnesota has also been about 4%. Because the base, the number of payers and the premium tax is so much smaller, it's subject to more volatility as there are changes in sort of payment timing or cash flow decisions made by payers. So we see a little greater volatility there. It's also not capturing the entire insurance market. So as there are changes in private health insurance, that sort of changes the trends in HMO premium tax collection. A question that we are asked.
Excuse me a moment. Representative Munson.
Just a clarifying question on the last slide. Can you just quickly speak to the negative 5% thing that jumps out at everybody?
Ms. Fink.
Madam Chair, that's a great question and one that I get asked often when I use this visual. It's really just a timing. You'll see there's a large growth in the previous year. It's just sort of based on when a payment was received.
Representative Munson, does that answer?
Yes.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you. So of the... So when we refer to the provider tax, we're actually referring to several 2% taxes on different provider types. Taxes on hospitals, wholesale drug distributors, ambulatory surgical centers, and then providers as a sort of smaller category within that. Of those four provider types, hospitals pay about 38% of the total tax, providers pay about 38%, drug distributors about 23%, and surgical centers about 1%. Within the providers, physicians are the largest sort of single payer. Over time, both provider tax and premium tax revenue have grown steadily. You'll notice that there is a drop from 2019 to 2020 when we don't have a full year of revenue collection, and then from 2021 through 2023, there's no provider tax revenue in the forecast. So I know Commissioners Malcolm and Lori are going to discuss the uses of the Healthcare Access Fund in much greater detail, but wanted to provide a high-level overview for you all. In 2021, the largest expenditure in the Healthcare Access Fund will be for medical assistance. It's about $878 million in the budget years. So this represents about 7% of the cost of medical assistance, and it is not sort of necessarily tied to services for any one service or any one group. It originated with Medicaid expansion, with paying for the costs associated with those groups, but it's changed over time. When asked to sort of equate how much does this buy, 7% is a relatively small percentage, but depending on the population group, it might be equal to the cost of care for about 200,000 parents or children, or something a lot smaller, like nursing facility care for 11,000 people. So it's not possible to sort of tie it back to any one group or service in particular. I'll let the departments talk more about the operations and grant programs that are funded from the fund, but wanted to highlight for you all what on the color copies is the purple slice of the pie, which is a transfer to the general fund. We transfer $122 million a year from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund, and that transfer is associated with a rate increase that's paid to medical assistance providers. When we expanded the provider tax to public program services, the legislature passed a rate increase to pay for that added cost. And that allowed us to pay for that rate increase using both state and federal dollars. And that is sort of money that is paid through public programs to providers that is then paid to the Healthcare Access Fund as a provider tax. And so that's the origin of that transfer, and we update it periodically over time. So as I mentioned, and as the chart showed earlier, revenue into the fund is falling significantly. This slide illustrates a dramatic structural deficit that we forecast. We expect a structural deficit of about $500 million a year after the expiration of the provider tax. And the structural deficit really refers to the amount by which expenditures exceed revenues. And so because we are entering this biennium with some money on the bottom line, we aren't necessarily in a deficit in 2021, and I'll talk about that on the next slide, but we will be spending more than we're bringing in, I guess as early as 2020. So my final slide is just illustrating our forecast balance in the Healthcare Access Fund. The legislature is currently setting a budget for the 2021 biennium, and we have a positive forecast balance in the healthcare access fund of $61 million. But when you look farther into the planning years, we forecast a deficit of $919 million.
Okay, reach the end of your slides. Is that the end of the presentation?
That's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to take questions now, and I'll be around.
Okay, and I think what we should do, members, is if you have clarifying questions just to what you've just seen, it's pretty basic, just facts about the fund, then we could ask them now, and then I don't want to spend too much time on questions right now because we've got two other commissioners waiting, but Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a clarifying question on slide 7 that shows the pie of the expenditures for the Healthcare Access Fund. Under the Minnesota Care State Appropriation of $53 million, is this money coming in from the federal government that's allocated to this fund? And if so, does it reflect what's going on with reinsurance? If reinsurance, is this pie chart showing what would happen if reinsurance continued or if it ended? Does it have any effect at all?
Ms. Bing.
Madam Chair, the state appropriation on this pie chart is it is sort of the outcome of federal funding that we receive. So the state pays for the cost of the program to the extent federal funding is not adequate, or there are some populations that aren't eligible for the federal funding, which is really what this reflects in the 2021 biennium. Because the current forecast reflects a two-year reinsurance program, so this pie also doesn't reflect any reinsurance programming beyond 2019.
Thank you, Representative Munson. That is a good question because we have right now we have $400 million coming out of the fund for reinsurance, but that wouldn't be in this pie chart if I'm understanding what you just said.
Madam Chair, that's correct. So if this pie chart was done for 2018-19, you'd see a pretty significant slice of the pie for the reinsurance program for the premium security plan. But this is sort of looking at a period in which those appropriations don't exist, and also the impact to the Minnesota Care State appropriation from the loss of BHP funds from the current reinsurance program. It really, because of the structure of the funding, and I'm sure Commissioner Lori can speak to this as well, that really hits our forecast in the 22-23 biennium.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on page 3, just clarification, the provider tax 2%, I believe it's spelled out in, 1.3 million or billion dollars? Right?
Raised.
And then the HMO, the 1%, would that be then subsequently the green and the lighter blue bar there? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for setting the table for us here. Mm-hmm. Oh, one more. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there is a balance in the reinsurance program. You know, we primarily spent just federal money drawdown in that. Where is that balance reflected in here anywhere?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, the balance in the premium security plan account is not reflected in this, in the Healthcare Access Fund. To the extent that there's funding remaining at the end of 2021, it would return to the Healthcare Access Fund, but that's not in the current forecast.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. All right, and members, we do have a quorum, so I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes of March 19th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuer moves approval of the minutes of March 19th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. Nice to see you again. I'm happy to be able to discuss some of the particular health department programs funded by the Healthcare Access Fund. They tend to be quite visible in some circles, but less well-known perhaps to the legislature as a whole. than the purposes that Commissioner Laurie will talk about. As Ms. Mingy just kind of took us through, since the very beginning, the Healthcare Access Fund has been intended not only to support insurance supports and people's access to direct care, but also initiatives to make the healthcare system itself more effective and efficient and more cost-effective over time. And that's indeed what many of the programs that we administer through the Health Department are about. So this just shows you a timeline of some of the key investments that have been made on the MDH side. Since in 1992, the first year of the Healthcare Access Fund, that's when, with this funding, we were able to start our entire health economics program, which I think, I hope you agree, has produced a lot of very valuable data for policymakers and for the community. On a number of fronts, helping us really understand in great depth what's going on, not only in the insurance market, but in the healthcare delivery system itself. It's the health economics program that really helps us know with precision what our uninsurance rate is, where uninsurance is concentrated, that we are spending, how much we are spending in total healthcare costs from all sources in the state because of the unique all-payer claims database that the Access Fund has helped us to build. And it leads to a lot of analysis that helps point us to potential strategies for healthcare improvement and cost reduction in the future. At the same time, at the very beginning of the Access Fund, we started the Office of Rural Health, which is entirely supported by the Healthcare Access Fund, with the exception of some federal grants that have come in since that time. But these two really foundational programs in our department were started under the Access Fund. In 2008, the last time we took a really kind of major comprehensive look at health reform in our state, some additional significant investments were made through the Healthcare Access Fund in strategies that would help us to start to bend the cost curve by giving us more tools to understand where and how to improve care quality and efficiency in our system through things like the all-payer claims database, through our healthcare homes program, through the statewide quality reporting and measurement system, all tools and analyses that have been created with the support of the Access Fund, and to work more systemically at prevention of the chronic conditions that drive the vast majority of healthcare spending through the statewide health improvement grants. All the programming funded through the Access Fund at the Health Department is kind of depicted on this slide in this graphic, which kind of creates three buckets, if you will, of the activity. The first activity around preventing disease is the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, which is a $17.5 million program. In the category of improving cost and quality, the Health Economics Division, the Healthcare Homes Program, and the Minnesota eHealth Initiative. I'm not going to go into detail on each of these things, but I am going to show you in a minute some of the examples of the kind of grant funding that comes in these areas. In the area of building infrastructure and access, this is really primarily about supporting rural and underserved communities that are frankly struggling to maintain access to critical healthcare services through programs like loan forgiveness to healthcare providers, support for particular strategies in rural and underserved areas like community clinics, grants to expand the healthcare workforce, and particular safety net, very targeted safety net grants to hospitals and dental providers and community clinics. But that graphic kind of puts those different grant funding streams, if you will, and programs into kind of their core purposes from our perspective. This next slide shows you the reach of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care in specific. So in 2018, this is a visual of where all the grants through the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care went in our state. And as you can see, we're very proud of the fact that this fund is helping to support access to care directly all across our state through loan forgiveness programs, these grants that I mentioned, a very creative, really nation-leading program helping international medical graduates to be able to apply their skills in Minnesota, and as I mentioned, health internships to expand the workforce. This slide just gives you some very specific vignettes, very micro examples, but I think illustrative of what these grant programs do. In St. Cloud, for example, a clinic is using their community clinic grant fund to help train their mental health providers in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and psychiatric medication management, bringing a much higher level of sophistication to the services that this community clinic is able to provide to St. Cloud residents. In Rochester, a dental clinic has used its grant to significantly expand their dental clinic to reduce a 3-month wait for dental visits and a 7-month wait for a hygiene visit. So very direct investments in a capacity building that is directly improving healthcare access. In Duluth, the Teen Health Center provides coordinated services to help find stable housing, STD testing, and behavioral health services for homeless youth struggling with mental health and sobriety. So I just selected these examples to show you sort of both the variety of the ways in which providers in Minnesota are making use of these funds, but also some of the direct human impact that the grants are making. This next, used with permission of Dr. Alyssa Kaying Vang, is a way of illustrating what the loan forgiveness program is doing for some providers in our community. Dr. Vang is one of the first Hmong-speaking licensed psychologists in the entire country. With the support of the loan forgiveness program, she was able to do some pretty wonderful things in service to her community. She's a strongly community-focused and mission-based physician. When she was accepted into the loan forgiveness program, she was able to open up a second office in St. Paul on University Avenue, which absolutely expanded access to her community and reduced transportation barriers to that population. She also was able to broaden her services to Hmong families in the West Metro area. Prior to being part of the loan forgiveness program, and she has shared this with us herself, because of the amount of student loan debt she had, she really had no choice but to kind of fully book herself in her suburban clinic, providing services only to insured people. And with the loan forgiveness program, she was able to follow her passions and serve her community by being able, she didn't give up her entire suburban practice, but was able to start clinics and expand her services to her own community. She's also taken the financial flexibility that the loan forgiveness has given her by not having to pay off that student debt to give of her time to help train newly graduated Hmong-speaking clinicians on culturally competent and clinically effective services to Hmong clients. So I find this a pretty interesting example of the multiplier effect that some of these might seem to be, you know, very individually targeted programs can have in our communities. Now to talk for a couple of minutes about the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership. This is this was a core part of the 2008 reform strategy to say we're going to take a really comprehensive, systematic approach to trying to deal with the major risk factors, the big three as we call them, three major risk factors that are in common linked to so many of our major chronic diseases that drive recent estimates are upwards of 80% now of all healthcare spending is spent on a relative short list of chronic diseases: heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer. And these all have common risk factors in the community. So the origins of the SHIP program were about, well, okay, what are we going to do statewide to really try to attack risk factors that are ending up in these preventable and very expensive diseases? So we now have, and you see here on the visual, we have literally got activity going on through the SHIP program in all corners of the state. Through SHIP partnerships and SHIP coalitions in each of these, in each of our community health board regions, in each geographic area of the state. So SHIP programming is happening in over 5,000 individual programming sites, childcare settings, schools, work sites, housing facilities, healthcare settings, and community spaces. Over 2,100 partners are involved in this work, and over 850 community leaders have signed up not only to be part of SHIP projects, but to say, I want to be part of the SHIP leadership team. I want to help drive the strategies in my community that are going to be successful in working on these conditions. Members, I believe you have in your packets a fact sheet on SHIP that is specific to your district. We thought you'd be interested to see the programming going on in your very own areas. But we're just extremely proud of the fact that this is truly now matured into a statewide strategy. The kinds of activities that we're doing with SHIP really do cover the lifespan. And I mentioned the pretty wide, impressive array of sites in which SHIP programming is happening. And let's talk about healthy eating in schools, for example. Some of the SHIP-funded work that's happening is reaching over 1,200 schools and districts, helping over 470,000 students eat healthier. The SHIP program has directly improved the access to fruits and vegetables, for example, in our schools. In healthcare settings, 3.5 million people have been touched by some of the SHIP programming that is happening in 300 healthcare sites around the state, who are working with SHIP coordinators on prevention and management of chronic diseases, smoking cessation in particular, and falls prevention, all very significant and manageable risk factors in the clinical context. Active living in communities, 410 communities whose residents number 4.4 million people have taken specific actions to improve the livability from a physical activity standpoint of their communities, making sure that improvements that are made to the built environment, when those community investment decisions are made, that they're made with an eye toward improving the ability of citizens to use their cityscapes to support health for safe streetscapes for walking and biking for people of all abilities and all ages. And I have been in a number of communities talking with city planners and county commissioners who didn't know what this SHIP stuff was all about a few years ago, but now are really believers in the value of kind of community-based planning about how to improve their physical built environment as a way of supporting health for their residents. So these next couple of slides, kind of in some respects, I don't want to say they're the punchline, because I really believe in the inherent value of these projects, but I'm sure you're interested in results, as are we. These slides are quite interesting. This is a pretty recent analysis that folks at the department have done using data from the CDC that looks at, on the left side there, and I hope you can see it maybe more easily on your slide, on your hard copies than you can on the screen. What this shows is what was the obesity rate between 1999 and constructed this analysis to look at what happened before and after SHIP. So SHIP was passed in 2008. The funding began in 2009. The programming really began in 2010. So we took the time period of 2011 to 2017, and we said, if the trend rate of obesity and smoking had remained the same as it was between the years 1999 and 2011, if that trend rate had continued as it was, what would have been the cost associated with that trend rate, and what actually happened to the trend rate after between 2011 and 2017. And you can see, with both of these very significant conditions, we're talking about obesity costs Minnesota $3.2 billion a year. Smoking costs Minnesotans $3.3 billion a year. So if you can moderate the trend line, that produces very, very significant dollar savings. I want to be absolutely clear about this, though. We're not suggesting that SHIP is the sole cause of this drop, and we're not claiming that causality. But I think when you look at the fact, and I think that some of our other fact sheets clearly indicate that in both of these measures, obesity and smoking, we're doing much better than our neighboring states. So we know there are other things going on in the environment with regard to obesity and smoking, but we believe it's a pretty credible argument that SHIP has been part of the fabric of change in our state that is helping to improve healthy behaviors and improve the environmental supports for those healthier behaviors that we need in order to reinforce healthier choices for our people. So these trend lines, the absolutely measurable impact on the trend lines in obesity and smoking translate to some pretty substantial averted spending just by virtue of the trend line having changed. And again, I'm not suggesting that should all be attributed to SHIP. We don't have the data to parse out every conceivable factor that might have influenced those trend lines, but I do believe, again, the fact that SHIP is our umbrella statewide strategy, and with the reach that SHIP has built, I think it well deserves some of the credit for these results. So this calculus just takes the number of fewer people that those trend line changes represent with the excess cost data that national statistics show are associated with BMI of over 30 or whether someone is a smoker or not. These aren't data that we made up. These are national statistics on excess costs related to these conditions. The fewer number of people who have these conditions associated with the excess spending per person, as you see over this period of time, 2011 to 2017, adds up to a significant impact on healthcare costs. This would suggest that had those trend lines remained where they were, we would have spent at least $600 million more in healthcare over that period of time. So that, I think that's pretty compelling, but I think even more compelling is what the people that this represents, the lives that this represents, the number of illnesses and even deaths that were avoided because of these prevention successes that we've seen, the impacts on individuals, their life aspirations, their families, the economy. If there was a way to start, you know, kind of making a more comprehensive and holistic analysis of the economic effects, even it would be a much larger number. But the human effects is what I'm the most proud of when I see the truly statewide reach that SHIP has built over time. And I, you know, we started off talking about the big three risk factors and the kind of projects that are going on in these 5,000 sites all over the state. That's impressive. And I think you will hear, if you talk to your local folks, your healthcare people, your public health people, your business people who are involved with SHIP activities, I think you'll find that they find value in the projects. So do I. But what I'm also excited about is that we've now got this incredible network and capacity statewide of community collaboration of people who've learned a lot about what actually produces health and how to work together across sectors to work on whatever issues the community wants to tackle. And I've heard of, you know, SHIP communities and SHIP coalitions talking together about, well, how might we use what we've learned to do here on other issues that are important to our community. So I think our state's resources, the Access Fund resources, have not only demonstrably affected improved health behaviors and reduced rates of disease, but is also building some really impressive community capacity for community-driven change that's going to help us bend the cost curve over time. I truly believe that's true, and it's not only about bending the cost curve, it's about improving people's lives. So I'm going to end with just one particular story, again used by permission. This comes from the SHIP coalition shared by Faribault, Martin, and Watanwan. I'm partial to this because my dad grew up in Martin and his parents grew up in Martin, and so that sort of feels like home territory a little bit. So this is a story kind of given to us by this SHIP coalition in those three counties of a woman pictured here. This is Linda. Linda started smoking at 15 years old. She had some challenging circumstances in her life, and she had tried to quit multiple times, was never able to do it, like many smokers that I'm sure we all know. Linda now is proud to say that she's smoke-free. In her last doctor visit, Linda had been told that she had 3 spots on her lung from smoking. So she was pretty well motivated to try to take some action. But the environment matters when you're trying to do something as difficult as quitting smoking. Linda found out that the apartment in which she lived was going smoke-free, thanks directly to local SHIP activities to change local local ordinances around smoke-free rental properties. That combination of events, her doctor visit and the fact that her apartment building was going smoke-free, gave her the oomph to try to quit smoking yet one more time. With the aid of the SHIP partnership in creating these changes and the aid of statewide tobacco cessation resources and that supportive environment, Linda, 50 years after taking her first cigarette, Linda is now 7 months tobacco-free. And that's a pretty great story. SHIP has assisted all of the public housing authorities within Faribault, Martin, and Watonwan to become smoke-free, which means that 559 smoke-free units are now providing clean air to the children who play there, the residents who live there, the staff who work there. Like Linda, all of these groups are on their way to better health, and I think SHIP deserves some of the real credit for that. And not just SHIP, but the people in your communities who've really found a great support through this resource to come together to improve health in their communities. So thank you so much for the opportunity to tell you a little bit of the story behind the numbers that you hear, the dollars in the grant programs and the dollars in SHIP. I hope this gave you just a little bit of a peek at some of the people that are behind the numbers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and please stick around for questions. I think it's very striking. You know, we just today on the House floor had a discussion, part of which was about why don't we bend the cost curve on health care? And in fact, it's not an easy thing, and it takes a long time. But from what you've just showed us, it appears that we are hopefully bending the cost curve on health care costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So next we have Commissioner Lori. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am, once again, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, Tony Lori. It's good to be back with you again today. I enjoyed our discussion yesterday. And I am going to cover some of the value of the provider tax to the work of the Department of Human Services here. As we've already heard in some of the earlier presentations, and we know well, Minnesota has a long and bipartisan history and tradition of supporting critical access to health care services for Minnesotans all across this state. And the Health Care Access Fund itself supports these critical investments in the health of Minnesotans, our health care systems, and our health care services. Maintaining current spending levels.
Commissioner, could I have you pause for just a second? We're just getting these handed out, and I think if we could just wait a moment and let them do that, it would be, at least I find it easier to listen and look, so maybe we could just wait for one moment.
Were these a separate set of slide decks?
We're just getting the copy of what you're showing on the screen, so it just... It is kind of difficult to read it off the screen, so if we can just wait a moment here, and we'll get more benefit from your presentation. Okay, I think we're good. Thank you. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry. I didn't realize members didn't have it yet. So, Madam Chair and members, I'll continue on about the value of the provider tax and some of the services offered through the Department of Human Services, supported with the Health Care Access Fund, the primary source of which is the provider tax. So maintaining current spending levels on the items that we work with would require additional revenue into the Health Care Access Fund or identifying some new funding source. And absent an extension of the provider tax, the state risks massive cuts in the human services budget or additional pressures on the general fund. I mean, I kind of frame it like this always. I say, take a look at the Health and Human Services spreadsheet. You're going to have it before you pretty soon. Erase $700 million a year from it and try to make the promises that we've collectively made, you know, D and R, to the people of Minnesota, minus, you know, $1.4, $1.5 billion per biennium to support those services. And it's pretty tough. I've worked on these spreadsheets for a lot of years. So that's, it's just really critical. The provider tax is the single largest source of revenue for the Healthcare Access Fund, and it represents more than 80% of what is in the Healthcare Access Fund for revenue for 2019. The investments primarily support the healthcare coverage programs like Minnesota Care and medical assistance that pay for things like over half of all nursing home costs in the state, nearly half of all substance use treatments across the entire state, and more than 40% of every birth. I mean, more than 40% of all births, not of every birth. pardon me. These are really critical investments in the health of our people, our families, and our communities. And medical assistance and Minnesota Care, these health, the public health care programs run through the Department of Human Services, serve 1.2 million of our Minnesota neighbors, loved ones, and family members, and help them get affordable health care coverage through these programs. These programs provide coverage for people. These are also our stories that we've been allowed to share for people like Jamie, who after falling off a ladder on a painting job was able to access the care he needed to recover and get back to work. It was a long recovery and a painful one. It provided coverage for Ivy, who got nursing home care after her ALS progressed to the point where her family could no longer care for her in their home. And it also, according to Mike, a dairy farmer in on Minnesota Care, provided a huge quality of life difference by having this coverage. He actually said last week in a public forum that it's the one monthly bill that he actually looks forward to paying because the coverage that he has gives him such comfort that he isn't going to lose everything if something happens. And that's what all too many farmers and small business people and the people supported by our public programs face every year, every day and every month. So similar stories all across our communities that highlight the critical importance of these health coverage programs that we run. Medical assistance funding for fiscal 2018, as many of you know, Medicaid in Minnesota provides coverage to children and parents, older adults, people with disabilities, and adults without children. And it contributes significantly to our state's healthcare system by supporting public health infrastructure that Commissioner Malcolm was just talking about, hospitals, mental health centers, at-home care, community clinics, nursing homes, physicians, and many other health professions. And Medicaid, not Medicare, also is the primary source of coverage for people needing long-term services and supports, both in the disability side and in the nursing home side. And that's often a miss. People miss that. They think of Medicare as the support for older adults. Medicaid is the primary source for long-term services and supports in both.
And Commissioner, let's just kind of put a point on that. And I know you are, but this is really misunderstood because,
yes,
let's face it, the terms, the names of the programs are confusing. Medicare, the federal program, am I correct, only pays for 30 days.
90.
90, okay, after a hospitalization, like a rehabilitation period. But anybody who's in long-term, if they spend down their own resources, if they don't have, and what is it, like $68,000, $70,000 or even more per year for nursing home care? It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Right? And so that is what Medicaid ends up paying for, even for people who were middle class but run out of their own resources.
Lost their resources, became eligible for medical assistance. Medical assistance pays for half of the nursing home care in the state of Minnesota. And that is a point that I was trying to drive home. Thanks for
thank you.
Helping me highlight it. and so although medical assistance is funded with a blend of federal, county, and state dollars, the Healthcare Access Fund is really a critical source of state funding for our medical assistance program as well. And then the other piece, the Minnesota Care funding in fiscal 2018, Minnesota Care provides coverage to people who do not have access to affordable employer-sponsored insurance but have higher income levels than make them eligible for Medicaid. So this program currently serves about 83,000 enrollees, and many of these Minnesotans are entrepreneurs, farmers, part-time employees, and low-wage workers that are our friends and family and neighbors. Minnesota Care coverage also allows families to access care with low out-of-pocket costs, compared to the private market and includes comprehensive benefit sets like vision and dental and the model mental health benefit set, both behavioral health services, mental health and chemical dependency that are just not available on the individual market, not to mention some of the best networks so people are able to receive care near their homes through these programs. And as we talked about yesterday, when Minnesota Care became a basic health plan, or a BHP, the state began receiving federal funds equating to 95% of what the recipients would have otherwise received in the value of advanced premium tax credit and cost-sharing reductions. And overall, about 87% of Minnesota Care's federal funding currently comes from this BHP premium tax credit and cost-sharing reduction calculation. The remaining costs of the program are funded through the Health Care Access Fund and by enrollee premiums. So the impact of the sunset of the provider tax is, it cannot really be overstated. Allowing the provider tax to sunset threatens the financial stability of healthcare in Minnesota and has major consequences for the hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans that rely on services funded by the Healthcare Access Fund. Under current law, with the provider tax sunsetting on December 31st this year, the fund will have a structural deficit and the funding streams will be insufficient to support the existing expenditures by 2021. We need to continue this provider tax and by repealing the sunset and help ensure that medical assistants and Minnesota Care enrollees can get the care they need by maintaining the revenue from this longstanding source in order to support the health care needs of more than 1.2 million Minnesotans and stabilize the funding for the health care initiatives to increase access, improve quality, and contain costs. You know, and then just to try to draw a point, here, if we're trying to reduce the expenditures in medical assistance, to try to accommodate a loss of funding of this magnitude, our budget team put together a sample of optional services. If you want to cut costs, you need to either get, you know, cut enrollees, cut provider rates, or cut services. There are not that many optional services. These are some of the optional services that we do provide today, and this is really instructive because these are services that we've collectively decided are very, very valuable to the people of Minnesota. Medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, MAEPD as we know it. We could eliminate this program. It is an optional program. I'm not suggesting we do. I think it would be horrible to do so. We could eliminate the tax, the TEFRA program for parents, you know, higher income parents with disabled children that need access to the medical assistance benefit set. I am not suggesting we do this. I think this would be a horrible idea. But it is an optional program that we are not required to put forward. That's what each of these are going to be. We could take away medical assistance coverage for adult dental, for chiropractic services, for PT and OT and speech and hearing and vision. These are the optional services that we could try to control Medicaid costs with. We could remove enhanced housing support rates from most residences. We could cap community access for disability inclusion, the CADI waiver, and the disability the developmental disability waiver. We could put caps on these programs. I'm not suggesting we do. I'm trying to draw the point. These are the things that we've collectively decided that we believe is good policy, and we get a benefit for these investments across the state of Minnesota. We could eliminate all of these really critical but optional services, and we've only begun to scratch the surface of the deficit created by repeal of the sunset of the provider tax. If we allow this provider tax to sunset, these are the choices we're going to be faced with. And these choices that I just laid out only make up 15% of the difference. We've got a long way to go. And this type of exercise I find very instructive. It's sort of how I started. Take a look at the Health and Human Services spreadsheet. Erase $700 million a year from it and try to keep the promises that we've collectively made to the people of Minnesota. Pretty tough to do. Not a fun exercise. That's all I got.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. And I've got a couple members with questions. Members, what I'd really like to do, we have a couple of testifiers from the counties. And I think if our commissioners can stay, can you stay, Commissioner Lurie? if it's okay with members, I know I see Representative Zerwas really wants to say something, and but Munson is would be first. So if these are short questions or short comments, we can take them. But I'd really like to let our county people talk, come and talk, and then we can have lots of time for discussion and questions. What's
Madam Chair, I didn't say lots of the time.
You'll wait.
I'm okay with waiting.
Are you okay? Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. It's just because we're so late. Is it? Well, you got on there after, Representative. I'm going to let our county testifiers testify first. And thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we have two testifiers, Rod Franks and Ross Owen. And maybe you'd both like to come up, and if that would be okay. And you have some comments for us. So who's going to go first? Mr. Franks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The last time I was honored to share in this hearing room, I had a very dignified approach up to the podium, which included tripping on that last step in the gallery.
All right. Now, please don't forget to tell us your name.
Yes. Rod Franks.
Okay.
And I'm glad to say that I have made it to the podium tonight with my self-esteem fully intact. Chair Liebling and members of the committee, thank you on behalf of counties for the opportunity to share this evening regarding the Health Care Access Fund. My name is Rod Franks, and I have the distinct pleasure to serve in the county in which I reside as the Health and Human Services Director at Carver County. As you have already heard today, the Health Care Access Fund supports key health and human services programs for Minnesotans across the state. These include access to Minnesota care and medical assistance, as well as the community initiatives that are served by our statewide health improvement partnership known as SHIP. These are key programs that Minnesotans across our state would certainly suffer without. For example, looking at children and the child welfare system, we know that having access to health insurance and quality health care improves child well-being. This includes managing chronic conditions, preventing illnesses, but also influences a child's ability to learn. Children and adults who are healthier and able to learn are more economically secure. In addition, access to stable and quality physical and mental health care are protective factors for families that certainly may lessen the likelihood of children being abused or neglected, and certainly reduce the need for very expensive out-of-home placements. The Health Care Access Fund pays for more than treating people's health care needs. We all know that the best way to treat an illness of any kind is to prevent it. The Statewide Health Improvement Partnership works to do just that. SHIP dollars go to our community health boards and make prevention possible in all of our counties. Among other initiatives, communities throughout this state have been able to focus on making changes to improve physical fitness, reduce tobacco use, and increase access to healthier foods. For many in our rural counties, multiple barriers exist when it comes to accessing health care, including there being enough providers and specialists available. The Health Care Access Fund, by increasing access to health care coverage, substantially reduces barriers for our rural Minnesotans. Now, if we are looking at nearly a $700 million less in revenue coming into the state next year to support these programs, this is just not a number that counties can afford to absorb. Critical to this discussion this evening from a county perspective is the increasing role county property taxes are relied upon to finance health and human services in our state. Since the creation of the Health Care Access Fund, financing health and human services at the local level has changed in numerous ways, and here are some examples. Starting in 2011, counties have continued to have to add additional staff regarding the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and this is due not just to increase numbers of persons' eligibility for health care programs, but also to manage the challenges of the meth system. Counties are also now responsible for 100% of the cost at the Regional Treatment Center in Anoka, as well as the community behavioral health hospitals when individuals no longer meet the medical necessity requirement. The county cost for daily care at these facilities has nearly tripled, and that's in less than a decade. counties have also incurred millions more in costs beyond the increased funding in 2015 related to the implementation of the governor's task force on child protection. Those recommendations are, and the concurrent occurring substance abuse epidemic. So counties have actually had to fund additional resources to really meet those challenges. And in 2017, the legislature enacted a county cost share for the non-federal share of the MnChoices administrative expense. Counties now pay approximately 18% of the non-federal share. The workload didn't get less, but the revenue to counties did. Again, local property taxpayers were asked to make up the difference. Counties have long cautioned that an increased reliance on local property taxes is not a stable way to fund and maintain human services for the long term. We fear that changes to the Healthcare Access Fund would move us closer toward that trend. Significant changes in the Healthcare Access Fund must be very carefully considered. I ask that this consideration include the impact on counties and the people that we're called to serve every day. While counties do not have an opinion on the specific funding source for the Healthcare Access Fund, we do support the principles of financial stability and the quality of the programs offered that the Healthcare Access Fund has made possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Franks. Mr. Owen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ross Owen. I serve as the Health Strategy Director with Hennepin County. And a lot has been said about the Healthcare Access Fund and the various taxes that fill it. And I'll try to add a few things from the unique perspective of Hennepin, where in addition to the county issues that my colleague from Carver laid out very well, we at Hennepin also make up a good portion of the safety net provider services that are delivered in our community. We wear a lot of hats at Hennepin when it comes to health and health care as a hospital and system of clinics, a health plan that serves as a financer of health care, a human services agency, public health department, corrections functions, and many more.
No wonder we're always so confused by Hennepin.
And so, you know, this necessitates that we take a whole system approach to coverage and health and health care issues. And from this whole system perspective, we really want to underscore the value and the importance of publicly funded, government-administered health insurance coverage for the residents of Hennepin County. We strongly seek solutions that maintain or expand that publicly funded coverage for low-income residents in particular. Residents of Hennepin County rely on the county for health care services, as they do in other counties in Minnesota, and those services rely on revenue from public programs to exist, plain and simple. The erosion of public health coverage in counties would simply shift the financial responsibility for that care to county property taxpayers, and this happens in Hennepin County in a very direct way, in part through taxpayers bearing some of the financial burden for uncompensated care and bad debt delivered at Hennepin Healthcare or Hennepin County Medical Center. The majority of the patients served in our hospital and clinics across the system are covered by public programs, so clearly the financial impact of reducing that coverage would be extremely damaging to the services that we're able to provide today. From a larger healthcare system perspective, this committee knows as well as or better than anyone that, you know, healthcare costs continue to increase. And as that happens, the legislature is going to continue to be asked to make up that difference between what care costs the system to provide and what people can afford in terms of coverage and access to those services. And one of our fears at Hennepin is that eliminating the provider tax would simply concentrate the burden of those rising medical bills in the public programs in other parts of the system, including the individual market, where the legislature is clearly focusing a lot of significant effort, where people are already paying more than they can bear for coverage. And those cost shifts, we think, would do a lot of disservice to other populations beyond the public programs that are the focus of this evening's hearing. Back to Hennepin's kind of whole system approach to health coverage, counties are required to look at those other policy areas like corrections, housing, and human services as part of health. We recognize that it's all connected. And when we look at the public costs that go into counties running those other systems outside of healthcare funding, we see some interesting patterns. I'll give one example. When we add up all of the costs across those sectors that come through Hennepin County, one of the patterns that emerges is that people with co-occurring mental health conditions and substance use disorder, so-called dual diagnosis individuals, make up more than half, about 54% of total public costs in all those other areas besides health care. And so with or without health coverage, this is a population with significant health issues that are driving system engagement in all kinds of other ways that we feel are very important. Clearly, access to health coverage to address those mental health and addiction issues are critical to the societal and policy goals that we all share. If health care coverage for this population is threatened, important solutions would disappear from our systems of providing these services, but these people and their cost to the system would not disappear. You know, we've been hearing a lot of doomsday scenarios and a lot of scary propositions for how to make up the shortfall in the event that the provider tax is sunsetted. I want to provide a little bit of a positive frame and tell a little bit of a story about how in Hennepin County, the expansion of public coverage has really spurred a lot of innovation and has really improved our system's ability to deliver services. Because healthcare entities are managing and accountable for the financial risk for healthcare services, our county system has changed for the better in a lot of important ways because of those resources that are made available. For example, when we discharge people from the hospital who we know are experiencing homelessness, we now provide them with different resources and supports in the community to reduce the chance that they'll be readmitted back to the hospital. We're also leveraging the ability of mental health services and substance use disorder treatment to reduce people's repeat engagement with the correction system. And these are simple, obvious examples, and there are many more. Because of the current commitment to fund health coverage for these populations through the Healthcare Access Fund, we as a county system have much stronger financial incentives to coordinate care for people and make that care work better. We've been able to reduce hospital ER visits and increase people's connection to primary care and preventive care. Again, expansion and maintenance of public coverage has spurred that innovation. Last, I want to reiterate some of the themes that Commissioner Malcolm raised and say that Hennepin's work, along with other counties in the area of health reform, has repeatedly shown us that when we invest upstream in prevention and maintenance of chronic disease versus caring for avoidable catastrophes, we're able to buy a lot more health for a lot less money. We would rather provide care in the community and in the clinic than in the emergency department or the jail. We would rather use waiver services to allow people to live in their homes versus in an institutional setting that's more costly and more restrictive for them. The Healthcare Access Fund and the provider taxes support for public health investments, in addition to these coverage issues, play a critical role in our ability to deliver care in these more efficient ways that produce better outcomes. We believe in all counties in Minnesota that this is the kind of smart investment that the legislature wants counties to be doing. And our ability to continue to do so is essential that coverage have a stable funding source like the one that is currently working for Hennepin and other counties. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Owen, and we appreciate it. And so we're going to take member questions now. And so if we'll probably, I don't know who the questions will be directed to, but if you can hang around for a little bit in case any of them are for you, that would be just great. Thank you very much. All right. Representative Munson, thanks for your patience.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Commissioner Lori and the first testifier. Is it Anna Mingy?
Oh, Anna, Ms. Mingy.
Mingy?
Yeah.
So for Commissioner Lori, trying to figure out which sheet it was. On slide 5 of your presentation, that shows the pie chart for the Minnesota Care funding. I'm learning this funding source, and then everything kind of gets a little confusing again. I don't know if you were in the room earlier when I was asking about the BHP funds. from the federal government that I was of the understanding that we lost money because that money was redirected from the federal government to the reinsurance program, and so they left a hole in the Minnesota Care funding. Is this pie chart reflective of that hole, or are these federal funds the funds that we received from Minnesota Care in addition to the money for the reinsurance program?
Commissioner Lurie.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, this is money that is the BHP formula that fed the BHP trust fund that had been building up a balance, and this is for fiscal year 2018, and there was sufficient funds in the BHP trust fund to pay for, I think, 87% of the non-federal or of the cost of the whole program. The balance was made up by some contributions from the Healthcare Access Fund as well as enrollee premiums. Now, if we do continue to run a reinsurance program and reduce the amount of revenue coming into that BHP trust fund, we will run into a point where that green part, which is the Healthcare Access Fund expenditures supporting Minnesota Care, will grow significantly, and the federal funding will shrink significantly if we continue to try to run these programs simultaneously. So this is reflective of a time largely prior to the reinsurance and when working off of a balance in the fund.
Okay. And then
Representative Munson.
Follow-up question. I'm not supportive of the provider tax because just on a principle, taxing people who are sick or taxing their services only raises the cost of health care. Probably not a surprise to people. I'm voting against that if I have a chance to. But I'm wondering, have either of you looked at allocating our state's sin taxes to go to the health care access fund? So the I think it's about just under $50 million a year. So $100 million per biennium from the liquor tax. Tobacco tax, I think, is about $335 million. The tobacco lawsuit, the settlement money, $150 million. So that would be about $534 million per year, just over $1 billion per biennium, which would offset this provider tax. And I know it leaves a hole in our general fund, but according to the World Health Organization, there's 25 countries, including Canada, that take their tobacco tax and use it towards health. And alcohol, I think there's another 10 countries that use their alcohol tax specifically targeted and earmarked for health. And it makes sense to me, as opposed to just going into the general fund. And, of course, we could also put the opioid settlement money directing it towards there. I mean, obviously we don't have any yet, but I think that's probably coming. And it would make sense that that would be used for health purposes as well. Have you discussed doing this? I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
Commissioner Lurie.
Representative Munson, you know, sin taxes is a source of revenue. Those that you listed, I think you maybe gave a little short shrift to the idea that it creates a general fund hole. I mean, all of those were existing sources of revenue that are spent, and, I can't rattle off exactly where each of them go right now. Well, and if they go into the general fund, they're hard to track from there. But some of them actually do have specific purposes for which they're dedicated, the ones that you listed. But, you know, once again, you know, reducing other streams of revenue that are already dedicated to other purposes doesn't really solve our problem here. I mean, we'd have to have a conversation about each of these other sources. And, you know, to your point about a philosophical disfavoring of the provider tax as a mechanism, you know, I personally take that criticism very, very real. I mean, I too think that in an ideal world, we would have a broader based tax structure that could support things like that. But we don't live in an ideal world. We live in this world. And, you know, Minnesota stands out in the country in our ability to sustain an investment in the health of our people, our families, and our communities. And key to that investment over a 26-year horizon has been this healthcare access fund. Is it ideal? No, it's not perfect. but it's better than any other state has been able to come up with in terms of being able to have that sustained overtime horizon ability that floats with the cost of health care. You know, it rises and falls with the cost of health care and the health care needs of our communities. It's calibrated in that way in a manner that is sensitive to the health care consumption and has worked very, very well. So I take your criticism. I accept it. And yet no other state has found that ability to have that continued reliable funding stream that allows them to achieve the really advantageous and enviable health status and being able to invest in the health of our people, our families, and our communities pays tremendous dividends in every sector of our state. It improves our economy. It improves the ability of workers to show up to work more days, healthier. It improves the ability of our kids to learn better when they have their health and their family's health and they're coming from a home that has better health. We achieve phenomenal statistics because of our willingness to sustain an investment of this type. Ideal? No. But we have yet to see a better one.
Okay. You know what? We've got other members on the list. I'm going to go, I think, if it's okay, Representative Munson, I'm going to go to Representative Zerwas. He's been very patient also. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and special thank you to all three commissioners and to our county folks for staying tonight. I know some members of the majority got a little chatty this afternoon, and so...
Majority? Okay.
You picked up on the joke, I think. I think you got there. You got there. Some members got a little chatty this afternoon, so I appreciate you staying into the evening. Really appreciate that. First question is for Ms. Minky. If we look at the last several bienniums, looking at 2013, 2015, 2017, in each of those three budget cycles, a considerable amount of money was transferred out of the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund to pay for other parts of general fund expenditures. If you have the numbers available, I'm wondering if you could refresh the committee on what those transfers out of the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund were.
Ms. Minky?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the numbers directly in front of me. They are in this giant binder of papers, but I can sort of share what I know. Beginning in 2013, that was the first year in which the legislature appropriated funding for medical assistance out of the Health Care Access Fund, and by doing so changed sort of that there's an inverse effect on general fund medical assistance spending. So that was one change that occurred in 2013. There were also some transfers to pay for medical assistance expansion costs. In 2015, there were a transfer from the general fund to the Health Care Access Fund of $455 million that was then used to pay for higher Health Care Access Fund spending for medical assistance in the following year. And then in 2017, the most significant change was an updating of that transfer that I discussed earlier this evening. But I am happy to share with the committee sort of a more thorough background on the history of that sort of interfund dynamic, because as I think it's really clear, the general fund and the Health Care Access Fund have a very like interconnected relationship.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the lines have been pretty blurred with money going back and forth is how I would see it. Wondering, we've seen over the last, I believe, 3 years in the fall and spring forecasts, we've seen within the MMP forecasts, the monthly amounts of money being expended that weren't captured as budgeted when the delay in periodic data matching didn't occur. I'm wondering if you have the numbers in front of you over the last 3 years, how much was expended during that time of delay of implementation.
Ms. Mingy, Madam, I know you're smart, but I don't know if you got all that in your head.
Madam Chair, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I would say that the original fiscal note assumed some savings to Minnesota Care from periodic data matching, and since then, because of the way that forecasts change, especially related to our BHP funding, and we would need to sort of work with the department to update that analysis, but I'm happy to reach out to the department and follow up.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. If I remember correctly, from the fall forecast following the delay in the implementation, it was going to be implemented the following August, and it wasn't. It was delayed for a full year. And then the fall forecast after that, I think the estimate was around 20, was it $27 million in the quarter? I think we were around roughly $100 million in delay for the year in expenditures that were expended but had been, could have been saved if periodic data matching had been implemented.
Ms. Mingy?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the answer to that question with me, but I'm happy to follow up with the committee.
Madam Chair.
All right. One more, Representative Zerwas, because we have other members on the list.
Yep, and my last question.
Please, go ahead.
It's just a request.
Yeah.
I know for 3 years, MMB, while the House and Senate passed periodic data matching, it was signed by Governor Dayton, and it took, I believe, three years to be implemented. It was just implemented like 2 months ago, right? That's my understanding. I think one, if that's accurate.
Madam Mr. Chair, the Senate, Representative Zerwas, it was very recently, yes.
Yeah. And so I guess I think it would be very beneficial for the committee. I know for a while MMB was tracking how much money the state was expending for folks on public programs that didn't meet the bare qualifications for the public programs that they were enrolled in. And the amount expended over the last 3 years while that wasn't implemented, I think that data would be helpful back to the committee, and I'd request that that be reported. And I know in the policy committee, there was some data provided to the policy committee about the first 2 months of periodic data matching that, if my memory serves me correctly, showed about a 10% error rate. And so if that information could be provided to the committee. My question, Madam Chair, is as 3 years later, we have implemented a bipartisan piece of legislation to make sure that taxpayer dollars are going to those that qualify, what's the savings amount? What was the savings potential the last 3 years? And when we look at what's been transferred and spent from healthcare access fund money that gets moved into the general fund for other expenditures, how close are we? And I think if we capture, if we don't spend the money on folks that don't qualify for, meet the basic qualifications for the public programs that we're enrolled in, and if we don't spend money out of the healthcare access fund for non-healthcare items, what's that true hole? And so I think if that data could be provided to the committee, I think it would help us as members as we approach making the decision around possibly voting for a tax increase or keeping the status quo.
Okay, well, thank you, Representative Zerwas. So I guess that commissioner and the staff, I think, heard the request, and they can, I think, get that to you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioners, thanks for your presentation. This is off the top of my memory, but I think there's only two states in the nation, Minnesota and New York, if I remember correctly, and Commissioner Lori, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that have a BHP or Minnesota Care plan. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that is correct, Minnesota and New York. New York's isn't a Minnesota Care plan, though. But
okay, then what do the
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, then what do those other states do with that population?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the other states, that population from 138% of federal poverty level to 200% of federal poverty level would be shopping on their exchange for qualified health plans on their state's respective exchange.
Madam Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
So in other words, they would qualify for federal tax credit to help them with the purchase of individual health insurance, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that is correct. And just kind of try to picture yourself the population between 138 and 200% of federal poverty level and what the offerings on the individual market would give them. They would give them much lower actuarial value. Minnesota Care operates at a 94% actuarial value. 87% of the costs, the slide is up right here, are covered by the federal money that we capture through the BHP funding mechanism. We capture some premium revenue and have a very modest state investment through the Health Care Access Fund to provide broad networks, phenomenal benefit set that includes vision and dental and the model mental health benefit set, as well as chemical dependency services. This is a really good deal for the state of Minnesota and for the 83,000 Minnesotans served by this product that significantly outperforms anything available on the individual market.
Representative Grunhagen.
One thing just to be reminded of, members, is that Minnesota Care currently reimburses at Medicaid rates. So it is a substantial loss for our Medicare provider, or our medical providers, versus the private market, which reimburses at a much higher rate than medical providers actually make money on that. Secondly, when we passed Obamacare, we expanded medical assistance, and maybe you addressed this already. But to what degree did we – some states didn't do that. I know Texas didn't expand. I don't believe they've expanded their Medicaid assistance qualifications. What was the degree of expansion that we did back in 2010, and how many individuals on Medicaid fell into that category of expansion?
Commissioner Lori.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the expansion actually occurred in 2011. It was one of Governor Dayton's first executive orders to do the early expansion up to 75% for federal poverty level for single adults. And then we expanded up to 138 during that 2011 session, full expansion. And I think the expansion population is, I want to say, 200,000 people were provided coverage through medical assistance, many of whom had previously been covered by our Minnesota Care program. And also, you know, a good number of disabled were caught in a situation where in order to get the benefit set that they needed, they had to go through the disability eligibility for medical assistance in order to gain access to their health care needs, and would have to spend down in order to make it onto that program. And by allowing people to come through the standard Medicaid door as single adults up to 138% of federal poverty level, we really improved the lives of a lot of people living with disabilities across the state of Minnesota.
So I'm going to go to Representative Hamilton, because we can't allow one member to continue.
You said
and have
three questions. That was on my last.
Well, anyway. We've got Hamilton, Cantrell, Schumacher, Schultz, Haley, and Franson. And we could be here till midnight, but that's kind of not my plan, Representative Grunhagen.
It's mine.
So, okay, well, you can stay late, but
I'm going to go discuss it with myself.
I'm going to go to Representative Hamilton. I'm sure you do that anyway, but okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, if it's not relevant today, you can ask me to put a pin in it, and I'll respect that, all right? However, I just received an email from a constituent before I came down here, and I'm asking it off of page 7 from the Commissioner of Health.
From which one, Representative
Hamilton? On page 7 from the Commissioner,
okay.
Malcolm. The three major risk factors for chronic disease are unhealthy weight, inadequate exercise, and commercial tobacco use. And literally, just before I came down here, I read an email from a constituent who contacts me quite often. And here's the situation. Works in a grocery store. An individual comes in who is receiving benefits. Use their EBT card and get cash. And this individual can see it happen. They then get their cart, they go through, they do their grocery shopping, and they come to the checkout where she works. And I think we could all agree on the, most of us would describe what's in the cart as junk food. She then pays for that, the individual pays for that, and then pays for cigarettes with cash and leaves. Every time this happens, I receive a phone call, right? And so I'm going to ask my question like this. Whether it's through ship dollars or others, if an individual comes in, is down on their luck, and you walk in, you visibly see that the individual is unhealthy weight, you can tell that they smoke and they admit that they do not exercise. Is there anything in place that we can help them with when they are signing up for benefits to address those three chronic disease areas, right, to address that? Is there anything in place currently? And like I said, every time this happens, or most of the time this happens, I receive phone calls, and it's a very small community, population around 4,000 people, and so everybody knows everybody, right? And when this happens, I receive a phone call. So I don't know if that's adequate, Madam Chair, that's my question.
Well, all right. Well, I'm curious to see what the commissioner is going to say. Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, so is the commissioner. Curious to see what I'm going to say. Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I'll just say I think that is a shared frustration that a lot of us in health care and public health have, is how can we do the best possible job of aligning public benefits to support health and to support healthy behaviors. In a prior tenure as commissioner, I actually tried to change some of those rules, and I had gotten in trouble with some of the legal authorities that I was exceeding my authority as commissioner. So I just announced that I have some personal sympathy for your question and your constituents' frustration. I don't have enough knowledge off the top of my head to know what are all the tools we might have as we're interfacing with public program beneficiaries to be connecting them with resources. I think that's the real spirit of your question, is can we do better for these beneficiaries? I'm just not familiar enough with the kind of that caseworker level of connection to give you a good answer, but I'm happy to get back to you on it.
Thank you.
And I think, Representative Halverson, did you want to speak to this point and try to answer that? And I also kind of had a little bit of an answer, but you please go ahead.
Yeah, and perhaps the commissioner can, help, if because I think that this was an unexpected question, but I think what the science is showing us is that Individual behavior and individual choices are really driven by the environment around us. So I think to the point about the investments that have been made in SHIP, that's where the investments have to go. And for us, you know, anybody getting to spend time judging an individual based on one encounter and one choice, I think is really concerning. And I think what the science is showing us is that it's not about one individual. It's about the environment around the individual. And so I think that the fact that we are looking at community-based solutions really is the answer to that question. But I can have the commissioner
comment. Thank you, Representative Howerson. And I would just add to that, Representative Hamilton, that, you know, we have kind of a general view in our country that individuals kind of should be free to make choices. And yet, when other people make choices that we don't see as in their best interest, it's really hard for us not to want to say, you're making the wrong choice, and we'd like to see how we can make you make the right choice. And it's very hard to strike a balance when we have public programs and, you know, but we've kind of gone around the block with this a lot on, for example, MFIP, where we just recently had a, and we will be hearing a bill in this committee about kind of, you know, what does it mean to give people sanctions for behavior that we don't like. And so this is a really big question, and I appreciate you bringing it up. I don't think it's inappropriate at all. And I wish we had a good answer for how we can make everybody do, you know, I mean, how can I make myself do the right health behaviors? Honestly, I'd like to start there.
Right. And so. Right. And yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think and I really appreciate the discussion, the conversation around this. And we do so much great work. When I say we, I'm talking about everybody. We do great work. And it's saddens me when you have the one example that I did that overshadows everything that we do. But again, time and time again, when you're on the campaign trail and everything else, that's the thing that comes up continuously. And it would be extremely helpful if we had an answer for that, that here's a series of steps that we're taking, you know, to guide people to make these healthy choices. You know, who's...
All right. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is for Commissioner Lori, if he's still here. Commissioner Lori, I just had a couple questions about the healthcare access fund. So in your presentation, we identified that about one in five Minnesotans are enrolled or are on medical assistance or in MinnesotaCare. And from the current projections that we're working with here, if the provider tax is allowed to sunset without any sufficient substitute, which it doesn't have right now, we're looking at past fiscal year 2021. We're looking at a pretty dire structural budget deficit in this healthcare access fund. So I'm just curious, what will happen to the people who are on MA or the people who are in MinnesotaCare once we get past this horizon where, like, starting in fiscal year 2022, we're looking at a pretty drastic deficit.
Commissioner Lori.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, you know, that's a question we can't answer. We would have to work with the legislature to determine how to make these cuts. And you're right, it's about 1 in 5, 20% of Minnesotans, about 1.2 million enrollees. And that's why my last slide, I tried to just demonstrate, you know, if we are going to make cuts of the magnitude that would be necessary in our health and human services programs, These are the things that are optional services that we've, again, decided collectively that these are ones that we want to put out for the people of Minnesota. You know, this list of optional Medicaid benefits only begins to scratch the surface. And these are decisions that we'd need to make through a budget bill and appropriations article through the legislature, and we'd have to make decisions like this, and they would be very, very, very painful for the entirety of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Lori. So essentially, if we don't seriously consider extending the provider tax, we're talking about folks who are on programs like TEFRA, folks who are on medical assistance and get their dental coverage, folks who benefit from the CADI program. So we're talking about really the most vulnerable people in our state, kind of their quality of life being on the chopping block as a result of a lack of suitable substitution for this provider tax, is we're approaching this horizon pretty rapidly. And, you know, for me, I've worked in home care for the past several years. This is, I know that there are a lot of folks who need even more services than are covered by the Health Care Access Fund right now. And to not have something that can substitute the resources that they rely on, to me, I think is irresponsible of us as a legislature to allow to happen. When we get past that 2021 horizon, we're going to have to start making cuts to people's lives, essentially, because when there's no more water in the cup, you don't have negative water, you have nothing. So, Commissioner Lori, I appreciate the work that you're doing and that the department is doing, and I really hope that the legislature takes this very seriously, because these are real Minnesotan lives that are at risk as a result of this. So thank you so much, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Members, I'm just going to let you know, we have Schumacher, Schultz, Haley, Franzen, and then I'm not going to take any more questions. Oh, and Representative Neuer, and then I'm going to make a brief statement, and then we will conclude. How about that? We will conclude. Okay, so.
I'll take your place.
Representative Schumacher, you want to take his place too? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have four quick questions and then just a brief comment. The first is a technical question. I was wondering when SHIP, if that was ever in the general fund, if it's always been in the Health Care Access Fund, and if it had transferred, when that transfer might have been.
And Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, yes, it has always been only in the Health Care Access Fund.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. The second question I had is, Commissioner Lori talked a little bit about the impact on Medicaid and just how much this contributes to seniors, especially in nursing homes. I'm wondering if nursing homes pay the provider tax, and if so, about how much of that contributes.
Commissioner Lori?
I don't believe, Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, I don't believe the nursing homes pay the provider tax. And so zero would be the amount.
Okay. That's pretty interesting.
Okay, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, they have the red surcharge, but that's a completely different topic. Question three that I had, is there, and I know the discussion is that we don't trust the general fund or legislators to always appropriate things to the general fund through that way, but is there anything that is funded in the Health Care Access Fund today that would be prohibited by federal law or anything like that from being funded in the general fund?
Commissioner Lori.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, no.
Okay. Representative Schumacher.
That, Commissioners, and Madam Chair. The last question, and then just a quick statement. The first set of slides that Ms. Mingy presented, we looked at the growth and the overall funds that were collected for the Health Care Access Fund over the term, and I'm just wondering how that compares to the amount of taxes that have been collected throughout the state and the amount of growth that the state's had economically, just how that compares. I think from what I've remember in studying this previously is that the Health Care Access Fund grows more than what the state budgets do and what the state's overall economy does or the gross domestic product does. And so I'm just wondering if you have that kind of information.
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the precise sort of growth rates with me, but as I mentioned, the provider tax has, over the last 10 years or so, grown about 4% on average a year, and The general fund revenues, I believe, have grown at a slightly slower rate, but I can follow up with the exact numbers.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to conclude some of my thoughts on this and how I've been framing this issue as we move forward and what kind of solutions we may have to get to at some point. But we know, and this isn't the tax committee, but that the provider tax is a regressive tax. And we know from tax incidence studies that this impacts those of less means a lot more than it does people with means. And we talk about how healthcare cost is raising throughout, well, every facet of our conversations. And this is a program, the provider tax contributes to that increasing cost in healthcare. And it's also a program that benefits from the increasing cost of healthcare, as we've seen from the trajectory there. And so that's kind of the mindset that I've been coming from with this, and I think that's an important part to keep in mind as we're talking about the provider tax and the future of these programs. And so thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for helping me out with those questions.
All right. Thank you. thank you, Representative Schumacher. And, you know, I would just say I don't know if any of the three testifiers can really speak to the progressive or more regressive nature, but I would have to say that, you know, when we look at the provider tax, since we're excluding people who are on the public programs are not paying the tax. So when you look at it across the board, I don't know if it actually would be a regressive tax. And when I look at this chart that was just provided by Ms. Mingy, and it's actually rather eye-opening to me that 23% is paid by the wholesale drug distributors, 38% paid by hospitals. I mean, I don't know if revenue could give us the index on how progressive or regressive it is, but it would be interesting to have that. But I think it's probably not as simple a question as meets the eye. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the commissioners and other testifiers that came tonight to talk about a really important topic. We have had the provider tax. It was a bipartisan revenue stream for a bipartisan program for Minnesota Care. So I think that's really important to recognize that a lot of work and effort went in to get this passed, and it would be a real shame if we didn't extend it to provide care for, and most people in Minnesota, they believe and they value that everyone has access to health care. This is widely a value that most people in Minnesota have. And I don't want to be here if the provider tax is repealed and try to figure out what we're going to cut. $1.4 billion hole in our budget. I don't want to serve on Health and Human Services. I don't want to be a legislator to have to face what we're going to cut when most people in Minnesota have this value that everyone deserves access to health care. And so much effort went into developing a revenue stream that could pass the legislature and get signed by a governor in a bipartisan way. Commissioner Lurie is right. It's not the ideal revenue stream. There are more better, more efficient ways to collect revenue that's more broad-based, but those revenue streams are not politically feasible to pass, like an income tax. So I just want to urge members to really, really think about not sunsetting the provider tax and keeping it so we can pay for high-quality health care for many of our most vulnerable. And if you don't prefer this type of revenue stream, you need to come up with other revenue streams so we don't have to cut $1.4 billion of health care services for people, some of our most vulnerable. And it's fine to have additional revenue in this fund because we're going to need it in the future for our long-term care needs. We could bankrupt the state just for long-term care needs in the next 20 years. So we need to have a healthy fund for not just long-term care, but for our most vulnerable. So I want to really urge members to really think about keeping this revenue stream for these vital programs and just recognize that it was bipartisan. And as Commissioner Lurie pointed out, it will be really hard to figure out an HHS budget when there's a $1.4 billion hole in that budget.
All right. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioners, for being here this evening. So first, more of a comment, and there's a question here, too. I agree with other comments. Of course, we want to provide quality health care for all the citizens of our state. And this was bipartisan when it was passed. So it was also bipartisan to have a sunset. And when I look at a sunset, it's a time for us to evaluate our programs, effectiveness and what we're paying and what return we're getting and are things working and are there other options. That's a very healthy thing to do. So I would like us to have the debate not on the current program, but what else, what other options do we have and how else could this look? Because the trajectory going forward, to Representative Schultz's point, is just scary for all of us as we consider so much complexity in our healthcare system and what it's going to take to provide everybody the coverage. I guess I also just have to comment and stand up for the taxpayer. And when I say that, those are the farmers and the electricians and the plumbers and the self-employed people and the retirees that aren't yet 65 in my district that are paying these taxes. They feel like they are carrying the folks on the public programs on their shoulders. My district is 70% public programs. The 30% are the people I just talked about. So they're paying the tax. They're paying for their health care. They're paying higher rates because of this tax. They're paying the higher county taxes that the county commissioner talked about in order for us to provide the services. My county had a 9% levy increase. So it's all of this loading onto the farmers, the electricians, the plumbers, the retirees, the self-employed. That's what I'm concerned about. And when you commented that one of your constituents says they look forward to paying their Minnesota care bill because they get health care, that would just be literally a stab in the gut to the people I'm talking about, the people that I talk to every day at their doorstep when they're saying, I gave up on paying for health insurance because I couldn't get health care no matter how much I paid. I gave up because a public pay person has adult dental, chiropractic service, PT, OT, speech, hearing, and vision, and I'm paying for my health insurance and I can't afford to go. I don't get new glasses. I can't go to the chiropractic and my back hurts because I'm hauling hay or I'm dealing with the cows. I can't do it. So that's what's not been in this discussion at all tonight or earlier. And I don't want to be a legislator if I can't help solve this problem. And so what I don't see in the modeling, and I don't want to take away services, TEFRA, or any of that, but what I don't see is what are our other options? Maybe Minnesota Care needs to come up a little bit. Maybe some services need to be changed or distributed differently. We really should address the waste and the fraud and the abuse that Zerwas talked about so we can help more of those folks in need. That's what I don't see in any of the modeling, and maybe you can comment on that. But this is very personal to a lot of people who are paying the freight, and they will not be able to keep paying these taxes and not have any health care so that other people can. We have to even the playing field. That is my request on behalf of all the people that I represent. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Neuer.
Could I have them comment on just some different modeling or different options? Well, I guess that was my question in that.
Well, Representative Haley, I guess, we could. I guess my reaction to that is first of all, I mean, it is 20 minutes to 9. We've been here way long, but also, and that's not your fault because you weren't taken up all the time, but, I think we're kind of, I mean, we're having a very, very broad discussion, which is fine, except that it is 20 minutes to 9. I think what I would say to you is, as a legislator, you could be putting forward solutions. I mean, frankly, you know, I think very few of us think we have the really great healthcare system. Unfortunately, what we deal with here at the legislature a lot of times is kind of pieces of it at a time. And we did talk today a little bit on the floor about, yeah, we need some better solutions. But, you know, some of what we also heard, and, well, kind of getting into what my closing comments were going to be, but, you know, I think what we heard is that a lot of what goes on from this fund is not just for people on public programs. What Commissioner Malcolm was talking about, the SHIP program, and a lot of the things we do are for everybody. They're not just for the public programs. So this discussion is not really just about public programs. It's about you all, your caucus, used $400 million out of the fund for reinsurance. That's not for public programs. So, you know, I mean, I'm not discounting your concerns at all, because we all share those concerns. I'm just saying that we're way afield of, you know, where how to wrap this thing up tonight. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, if one of you want to respond, do you have a short response that you can make to that, Commissioner Lurie?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Haley. You know, I'll just try to be brief and just sort of address the parity issue that you were talking about, you know, head on and say, look, I mean, these are cliffs, and these are very real, and they're really problematic. And you can look at it in two ways. One of the ways to provide parity is to make life worse for people on the, you know, on the side of the cliff, the public benefit side, or make life better for people on this side. And that's what we're trying to focus on, is really those pieces where we can improve the marketplace for people on, you know, above the 200% cliff, above the 400% cliff. Try to make sure that we have the subsidies available to bring the products within the price range, and then improve those products. Use our buying power to gain more leverage and buy pharmaceuticals at a more competitive price for all of the people that we're trying to serve here. So, you know, your concerns don't fall on deaf ears, but when I look at a cliff, I always try to look at making life better for people on the upside of the cliff, rather than providing parity by making life a little bit worse for people on the downside of the cliff. They want to live better lives, and these programs and supports that we offer people work, and they help people attain a better life, and they climb up that ladder, and they achieve lives that without these supports they're unable to achieve.
Okay. Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lurie, the question that I have is, we're talking about people, and if we don't have the health care access fund, we're going to increase the number of people who are not going to be covered, hence we're going to be dealing with health crisis. At the same time, also from the SHIP program, Commissioner Malcolm, if we don't provide support to the schools through the SAFE route, which wasn't included in part of the information, we're going to create another health crisis, because we're talking about health care and health outcomes. So looking through this process, so we have got almost 6% uninsured. Can you comment how many people will be uninsured by taking away the health care access fund?
Mr. Lurie.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, that's another set of decision points that would have to be faced by the legislature, as Representative Schultz said. I mean, this would be a huge cliff, a $1.4 billion per biennium loss in the middle of the Health and Human Services spreadsheet. The administration would have to come and work with the legislature to figure that out, and it would mean loss of coverage for a lot of people. It would mean lower benefits. It would mean lower provider rates. It would mean all of these things, and we could do really painful cuts in each of those areas and still have a lot of work to do to meet the budgetary challenges. This would be really incredibly disruptive to people's lives and to communities.
Thank you. Representative Neuer, did you want to follow up?
So the other part is with the aging population and knowing that this will, you know, the program supports the long-term care. And some of the smart reviews that we're doing, we're increasing the coverage for those individuals who are not otherwise will have been covered by Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot of things that are, you know, converging because of the decisions that we're going to be making in the next few months in this body. So long-term care will increase for sure if we don't have this program. Is that correct?
Commissioner Lurie.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, I mean, I think that with some of the services that we are trying to provide, we really focus on trying to help people age in place and not be so reliant on higher-end long-term services and supports. We would, you know, those would probably be some of the very services that would need to be cut back on, and it would not be a savings in the long run. It would have people seeking higher-end services earlier in their life than they otherwise would have to if we had the ability to fund in some of the upstream investments that are intended to keep people healthier longer and leading better, more productive, more integrated lives with their community and their family.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And I, you know, I appreciate everybody sticking around till really late. I just would like to say a couple things. One of the things, and I really have appreciated the all of the presentations. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that a lot of what goes on out of the Healthcare Access Fund, from SHIP to the health economics that Commissioner Malcolm was talking about, all the things that are, that the flexibility that this fund allows us, it's not just about the public programs. It's about all Minnesotans. And it gives the legislature the ability at times to address kind of urgent needs, which is what we saw when, you know, the Republican majority in the last couple years ago used $400 million out of that fund. You know, to my way of thinking, if we there are a lot of interactions here, and I think our county testifiers illustrated that extremely well, that when we don't take care of people's needs, they don't stop getting sick. They don't go away. They get sicker. And they, if we don't treat people, they end up in different parts of the system. And we don't really save costs. So I think that's really important, a really important factor to keep in mind. This fund and the existence of this fund, and while I agree it's not a perfect fund, and I've been a critic of it over the years as well, it has done a lot of good things for this state. And it really frightens me to think what would happen if the fund just went away. Honestly, we would be a very different state. And I think that would be unacceptable to Minnesotans. This fund does not raise health care costs. This fund saves health care costs. That's the reality. Just like sometimes when you run a business, you have to spend money in order to make money. This fund, we collect tax money in order to save money on health care. I think that that is really what this fund is doing. And I really, it really frightens me to think of it going away. So I really appreciate the discussion today, members. I just want to announce before we finish tonight our schedule for tomorrow. So we're going to see our commissioners again, and we're going to all feel we're going to be very, very familiar with each other because we are going to hear the bill that I'm carrying, which is the governor's budget. And I just want to say a bit about how the day is going to run tomorrow. So we're going to have brief presentations from the commissioners, kind of overviews of the bill. We're not going to hear this bill as though it was an omnibus bill for us. This is not our omnibus bill. I want to make that extremely clear, okay? So we're not going through this bill section by section. And this bill is ultimately going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, just like other bills that we've heard and will continue to hear in this committee. And, you know, that means that parts of this big bill will no doubt end up in our omnibus bill. That's not to say that all of it will. And so what we're going to do is have these presentations. We're going to take public testimony. And we're going to ask our testifiers to testify to get 1 minute. We're going to break down the testimony so that we're going to ask people to, we're going to have testimony on sections of the bill or topics in the bill. We're going to do it by topic. And I've never seen this done, but I hope it'll work well because what I have seen done has not worked. Let me just elaborate on that for a moment. When we have omnibus bills, usually we have a day of public testimony, and people kind of come through and they use their brief time to talk about whatever part of the enormous bill they want to talk about, and it is so disjointed, it's very hard for members to really follow and understand what they're referring to. So we're going to try a better method, I hope it'll be better, of kind of doing it by topic so that it'll hopefully make more sense to those of us listening and help us understand what's being said about the bill. So we're going to take that public testimony, and then we're going to, I assume that this is going to take our regular time, so we're going to come back in the evening and have our member discussion and any amendments. Okay, so we're going to put those off the evening. I would caution everybody, I am not doing any amendments to the bill. I've told the agencies I'm not taking author's amendments on the bill right now because this bill that we've got in front of us is not necessarily what we're going to have in our omnibus bill, if people understand. So we are doing a bill hearing. If a member wants to do amendments, you certainly can, just like members of the public can testify on the bill. But this is not going to be your big opportunity to offer amendments to these topics, is kind of what I'm trying to say to people. Are there questions about this? No? Everybody tired to ask questions? Representative Munson.
So I'm fairly new, but if you're laying the bill over for possible inclusion, why wouldn't we want to offer an amendment to it to improve it?
Because, Representative Munson, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. You certainly could, but what happens is when bills are laid over, we will put together an omnibus bill, and whatever is in that bill, we will go through in the committee section by section, and we will have public testimony on that bill, and you will have a full opportunity to offer amendments to that bill. So what I'm saying is you could do it to the governor's budget bill, but it may be just simply duplicative. I'm just trying to kind of manage our time a little bit and make a better process. But you, as a member, you certainly have a right to offer an amendment. I wouldn't tell you that you can't. I'm just saying as a committee, we may want to, it may not be, say you amend a section of the bill, it may not show up in the omnibus bill anyway, and you will have, you know, so you might want to do that to make a point or to have a discussion, sure. But if you're doing it to try to fix something in the bill, it's probably just not the most efficient time to do that, is what I'm saying. Okay, other questions? All right, well, thank you, everyone, for your attendance this evening. Thank you again to the testifiers. Very good job. We are adjourned.